So I was in that stage of sleep when in my body there was still the need for sleep, but there was a full bladder, right? And my consciousness was in there somewhere. And those three things were battling for control. Now, I often, strange to say, have bizarre dreams when that happens. And in this dream, I was dreaming about death. It wasn't pleasant. I was anxious about it. I was afraid. And in my dream, I prayed, "Please, Lord, let me be ready for it." And then a sense, again in the dream, of the Lord saying, "You will have just the grace you need at that moment." And I felt relief. And then, in the dream, instantly the scene shifted from this rather weird, troubling exchange to a formative time in my earlier, younger life, a time and a place in my life when I first connected with God in an existential, experiential way. The place I met Denise as well. And in that place, far from here in geography and time, the colors were radiant, warm. And all who I knew from that time, who had experienced grief and trauma in their lives and relationships since that time, were back together again. It was as if we'd all traveled through life together, taken whatever lumps and horrors life could throw at us, and now we were back at the beginning, with all of that still in place, not forgotten, but reconciled to it all, reconciled with each other. And then I woke up, and I was deeply moved by this dream. And I came down for a bite to eat, and I asked Denise about the dream, since she has this spiritual direction training. She's had Jungian dream analysis training. And she often doesn't answer my questions when I ask her about my dreams. Because she says, "That's not the point. You have to figure it out. You got to do it." But to this morning, she said, "Well, what comes to me is that you're dying to something." Immediately, I thought, yeah, that's right. And though I don't have the details of what it all means, I now recognize this dream to be an invitation. I'm being invited into something that is not ultimately fearful, but beautiful. Ultimately, not about losing myself, but about gaining God's quality of life. So this dream happened to me about a month ago. And a couple of weeks before ago, when I was beginning to read and think about this gospel story before I went away for a week of holidays, I made the connection between that dream and this text that was just read to us now. And I hope to make that connection obvious by the end of this homily. Today's story then begins with a group of Greeks coming to Jesus, coming to Philip and saying, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Presumably they've seen him in his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. So the physical seeing is not what they have in their minds. They want, of course, to speak with him. They want to understand who he is. But not just that. They want to understand who he is to them, right? For those of us who believe that somehow Jesus holds the key to our lives, maybe even to the world, is there anything else to ask for? Of course, we understand it's also a naive request, right? As naive as when some eager Christian, young Christian, says to the preacher, "I don't want to hear about any doctrine or religion. I just want to see Jesus. When are you going to stop talking about all that other stuff and just show us Jesus?" It could also be taken as a manipulative request, as when some first-time delegate to synod steps up to the mic and says, "You know, all this stuff going on here, this regulation, bureaucratic crap, we should just stop all of that and listen to Jesus." Ever heard that? Funny thing is that often it turns out that person and Jesus seem to agree on just about everything that should happen in the church, regardless of what anyone else thinks. But all of our sophistication about motives and hidden agendas doesn't mean that in the middle of Lent, we shouldn't be confronted with this request. "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Interestingly, Jesus in John's Gospel seems fully aware of the complexity of providing an answer. He doesn't go to them directly, have a little chat, you know, over a biscuit and coffee, gluten-free probably. He doesn't give Philip a couple of media bullet points as if to say, "Okay, show this to them. This will give them the information they seek." Doesn't do that. No, he's fully aware, I think. John, the writer, is fully aware that knowledge of God and of the human self is a genuine paradox. As modern psychology teaches us, we can't know ourselves without the input of others, but at the same time, we project onto others our sense of self. Especially when so many of ourselves' longings, dreams, and hopes are wrapped up in another person. It's a cycle, then, of imitation and projection. René Girard has written extensively about this, that can keep us hopelessly trapped in delusion about ourselves and about God. Or, with just the right people, the cycle just might lead out of the loop into freedom, into a transformed understanding of ourselves and God. It just might lead to where Jeremiah points, knowledge of God in our hearts, deep in our hearts. Here in John, Jesus understands that the Greeks, the disciples, and you and I, well, we all want to see Jesus. We all want Jesus to be who we want him to be, which is not really who he is, but what we think he needs to be in order to be of true significance to us. And so sometimes a straight-up question, straight-up request, is too fraught, too immense with implications to be answered head-on. It was the poet Emily Dickinson who said that to get at the truth of the most important things, sometimes we have to tell it slant. Come at it from a different direction. And this is so instructive for the church. If we try so hard to be relevant, we just might reinforce what people want to see. And so the Gospel of John's Jesus does not give the Greeks a surface viewing, but confronts Jesus' followers, confronts us, with the most concentrated group of sayings in John's Gospel about his death. Instead of meeting them where they're at, he gives them something to grapple with. So much of the church these days is about coming to a building and looking at what's going on there. Church as show, church as entertainment. like Jesus' entry into Jerusalem that had all the right props, the big crowd, the buzz, you know, the energy, the coffee shop. The event. One of the advantages, and I'm not proud about this, get it? I get that we've got all of our own issues. But one of the advantages of our small parishes and hopelessly out of touch liturgy, right? Ever heard that? Is that we're under no illusion about church as an event. We're here, we believe, because we want to truly understand and live into the significance of Christ for our lives in the world. And we know that's not easy, and we know that often we can't come at it straight on. It needs to sneak up on us, come around the backside. To ask to see Jesus is the right request. As long as we don't expect an easy answer, as long as we don't expect the manager of the store to pop up and smooth over all of our ruffled feathers when we don't get the service we hoped for. We want to see Christ, but the great Eucharistic tradition teaches us that we never will if we go it alone, if we just come with our desires. And that if we do that, we'll be stuck in this feedback loop, inventing a God after our own image and then projecting that God and his Christ back onto others. And so Jesus, talking about his death, is the perfect foil to our psychological wants. The church has never come up with one theory that explains Jesus' death, because that's not the point. Through Christ's death, no better, as we experience Jesus' death, then the feedback loop is broken. As Jesus says, those who love their life lose it. And those who hate their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. And I've been so bothered by that for most of my life. What the heck does that mean? What can it mean that's good? Hate their life in this world is not literally hating your life, your very self, but the pattern of life within the world's systems that seeks to imitate and then project onto others in ways that block us, that freeze us from the true knowledge of God, from what Jeremiah is getting at. This way of living, this feedback loop, is so normal to us, so ingrained into us, that it feels as comfortable as an old pair of slippers. It's just what we do. And that's why giving it up feels like dying. But here's the promise, like in my dream. See, I told you I'd get back to it. You will have the grace for this death. And on the other side of it, there is what the philosopher Paul Ricoeur called the second naivete. The recognition that instead of losing what was really important to you, it will be reconciled to you. It will be made whole. That's what we're called to believe. That's the step right there. We all need to see through another in order to come to know ourselves. That's what it means to be human. My dream is an example of that. I knew it was important, but I didn't know what it was. And Denise, helped me. It's extremely humbling to recognize that we are not transparent to ourselves. If we choose to know ourselves, then, by seeing through others who do not reflect God's reign of loving justice, we'll end up, at the end of our lives, carrying this sense of incompleteness, regret, regardless of our accomplishments, our work, our fame, our treasures. But if we come to know ourselves by seeing Jesus in the light of his death and embrace his path as ours, we will truly come to know ourselves in our work, in our relationships, in our play, even in our dreams. Do you want to see? Come.